Hello and welcome to the first episode of a new podcast that I'm going to call Tales from the Battlefield. So who am I and why is it that I had the idea of producing a podcast about the World War One and World War Two battlefields? Well, one of my earliest memories goes back to the late 60s or the early 70s, and it must have been Remembrance Sunday. The family that I come from lived in Abbey Wood, Woolwich, in southeast London. And I remember my father, I was only about 6 or 7 years old, I remember my dad standing to attention in front of the old black and white television, saluting the veterans and soldiers as they passed the cenotaph in Whitehall. And it intrigued me. And I remember speaking to my dad afterwards and trying to find out what he was doing and why he was doing it. And he explained to me that he'd served in the Army Service Corps during the Second World War and also out in Japan after the Second World War, and that his father and his uncle, who was my great uncle, had served in the First World War. And I think he told me, it must have been later on, that my great uncle, his uncle Henry, had been killed on the Somme in the First World War. The Somme, it meant nothing to me at the time, but it was to become such a major part of my life as time went on. So my life went on, and I went to school, got a job, and fast forward to the year 2001, and I received a phone call from a friend at work asking me if I'd got a relative that had fought and died during that Battle of the Somme in 1916, because he'd found a soldier on the newly created Commonwealth War Graves Commission website that matched my name. And indeed, it was Henry Wenham, my great uncle, that my dad had mentioned all those years ago. And it started me off on a journey, really, that was over 20 years ago. And since then, I've become an amateur historian, an amateur First World War and Second World War historian. And I take people over to the battlefields on what I call Terry's tours, looking at the places where their relatives may have fought and died, and also going to the famous memorials like the Meningate and the Tietveld Memorial. It's something, say, I've been doing for over 20 years. It's been a fantastic journey. During that time, I've collected hundreds and hundreds of stories, taken dozens and dozens of people to the battlefields in search of their relatives. And these stories were unheard. They were untold. They're not famous stories that you read about in the history books. And with the permission of those families, one of the reasons why I wanted to do that podcast was to tell those stories of those soldiers, some of which are still buried or missing on the Western Front or even beyond. I had a business career. I sat in an office for 40 years. People often ask me if I've served in the forces. No, I haven't. My interest in it really came from, as I mentioned, my great uncle's service in the First World War, and also my granddad, which I'll talk about, Arthur. So the idea is that this podcast will be a podcast to give voices to those soldiers whose stories have gone unheard, the ordinary men who went off to the war and did incredible things, things that we can only imagine are absolutely impossible to the likes of me. There's no way, personally, I would have survived one day, even in basic training, let alone getting out to the Western Front and doing the things that these brave men did. We're going to give them a voice that perhaps hasn't been heard before, and we'll tell their story. If people listen, if people don't listen, then I won't produce these podcasts. This is the first one, and we'll see how it goes. Now, I should, at this point out what I'm not. I'm not a professional historian. I'm not an academic. I have no qualifications whatsoever in history. All of the skills and experience that I've learned have been through actually doing the research, getting out onto the battlefield and doing the tours. There are lots of historians out there that produce fantastic podcasts, and these professional historians provide great detail about the history of the First World War and the Second World War. They go into great detail about the strategy and the tactics and what happened when the battles took place. That's not what this podcast is about. I'm not really qualified to tell those sort of stories. And as I say, you can learn those stories through tuning into other podcasts, of which we'll mention one or two of them as we go along. But really, this podcast is about telling the stories of those soldiers whose stories that I've researched over the years. So what's my experience of guiding? As I said, I first started doing this 20 years ago, when I followed in the footsteps of my great uncle and my grandfather, who, as I mentioned, had fought and died on the Western Front. And that meant that I had some experience of researching soldiers and it was a service that I was able to offer other people, usually small groups of families, and taking them to the Western Front, taking them to the place where their relative had fought and sometimes died. And I found it was an incredible experience, not just for them, but for me as well, to be able to stand on the spot where their grandfather had perhaps died in 1917 at Passchendaele or 1916 on the Somme, is an experience, no matter how many times I do it, will always mean a great deal to me. It's absolutely incredible. When you tell those stories and then you stand back and watch the family hold hands and stand in silence, sometimes for up to half an hour, where no one says a word, they're just standing there thinking about the great uncle or the grandfather that they never knew. As time went on, I developed more skills and built up more networks and got to know more people. And in recent times, I've carried out larger battlefield tours. In 2019, I guided my first ever school tour when I was asked to take a private school from Northampton to the battlefields of the Somme and also to Vimy Ridge, a unique experience, totally different to anything I'd done before. I'd never guided children before. I will talk about this trip on a future podcast. And then in August of 2018, I took part as a guide in one of the largest and most incredible events that took place during the centenary period. I was working for Ledger Battlefield Tours, and we worked with the Royal British Legion to recreate the Great Pilgrimage of 1928, when thousands of Royal British Legion members went over to the battlefields just a year after the opening of the Menin Gate. 90 years on, the Legion wanted to recreate that, and over 2,000 of their members signed up, and I think there was 50 guides, and we went over on a really hot few days to the battlefields of Vimy and to the Somme, and finally we took part on the 8th of August 2018, exactly 100 years to the day the Royal British Legion members recreated the grand pilgrimage that marched through Ypres, starting at the St Martin's Cathedral, through the Grote Market, and ended at the Menin Gate itself. It was an absolutely amazing experience. And if you go onto YouTube and type in RBLGP90, you can see a video of that incredible event, which was now over 3 years ago. So that's just a bit of background really about me and what gave me the idea of doing this podcast. I've got absolutely no idea whether anybody will listen to this podcast. We'll see what happens. I'll produce this one, I'll send it round to a few friends, and then if it's popular, then we'll distribute it. And if it does prove to be any kind of success, then I've got loads of ideas noted down. It's not just going to be me talking. If I was to talk for half an hour every week, I wouldn't even listen to it, let alone anybody else. But I've got loads of ideas of getting people onto the podcast. Some of the people that I've taken over to the battlefield will want to come on and talk about the trip and talk about their relatives. And we also want to look at the experiences of people that live and work on the battlefields. What's it like to run a bed and breakfast on the Somme, for example? We're going to do a podcast there. The chocolate shops up in Ypres, what's it like to run a chocolate shop in the middle of one of the most famous battlefield cities? And one of the reasons why I wanted to do that is because for the last 2 years, these businesses on the battlefields have been starved of our custom. Hardly anybody has been. I don't think in Ypres they've seen a bus for many a month now. Buses hopefully will start to go back in 2022, and we'll be able to enjoy the chocolate shops of Ypres and those fantastic restaurants on the Grote Market and around the town centre of Ypres. And also down on the Somme, there's lots of small businesses on the Somme that haven't seen anybody for these last 2 years. So one of the objectives of this podcast is to try and encourage people, now the COVID crisis hopefully is going away, to get back over the battlefield, whether you go on your own or on an organised tour, and go back and enjoy these businesses, which are desperate to see you, not just from a business point of view, but they want the company, they want to see people again. And hopefully this podcast will inspire people to do that. So just quickly before we go on, there's just a couple of people that I really need to thank who've helped me with the production of this podcast. The first one is someone that will be known to a lot of you, Paul Reed, the head guide at Ledger Battlefield Tours. Paul, as everybody knows, produces a fantastic podcast called The Old Front Line, and he's someone that I've been lucky enough to know for the last 4 or 5 years. And it was Paul that employed me to work on the RBL GP 90 event in 2018 and also a tour later on in the year. And he's been really helpful in giving me advice and encouragement on how to set up this podcast, where to get the software from, how to record it. And I'm really grateful to Paul for giving me the confidence to do that. And the other person who's really helped me, and I wouldn't be able to do this without his technical assistance, is Ben Skeggs from the ABF, the Soldiers Charity. Ben has kindly offered to host this podcast on the platform that the ABF use. And again, there was absolutely no way I'd have the technical expertise to be able to produce this podcast so that everybody could listen to it. So a big thank you to them, and there'll be more thank you to other people that helped me as we've gone along. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention was I mentioned that I am a volunteer with the ABF, the Army Benevolent Fund, but I'm also a volunteer with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. I'm one of their Cantor volunteer speakers, so I go out around Northamptonshire talking about the work, the history of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And I'm also a volunteer for their project that they call the Eyes On, Hands On project, where I go out and look at some of the 130,000 headstones that are in the UK. Every few months we go out, I think there's about 1,000 volunteers that go out and look at these individual graves. Some of them are in collective cemeteries to make sure their condition is okay, to make sure they're being looked after, and to report back the condition to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And it's a fantastic project that I've been involved with now for the last 12 months, going out doing talks, looking at these headstones. And it's something that hopefully, again, this podcast will encourage people to get involved with, not just the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, but the ABF, the Soldiers Charity. So I mentioned that one of the main objectives of this podcast was to tell the untold stories of these men and women that went off to World War I and World War II and either didn't come home or did come home. They've all got stories to tell and stories that perhaps have never been told before. So what I wanted to do in this first podcast is tell the story of my great uncle, Henry Wenham, and his brother, Arthur Wenham. So I mentioned at the start of this podcast how in the early 70s or the late 60s, I'd seen my dad saluting the black and white television on Remembrance Sunday. We're now moving the clock forward to April 2001. I was sitting in my office in Northampton and my phone rang and it was a colleague that I'd been working with for a number of years, and he asked me a question that was to change my life. He said simply, "Did you have a relative who died in the First World War?" And of course, my mind went back to my dad telling me about one of my uncles that had died on the Somme in 1916. It was that one simple question that changed my life and made me appreciate my lifestyle and set me off on a fascinating adventure. First of all, into the lives of my great uncle and my grandfather, but it also took me on a journey that would lead to me becoming a battlefield guide and helping hundreds of other people discover their own Great War relatives, and at the same time raising thousands of pounds to help the soldiers and veterans of today. That's really what I wanted to do. So in this first podcast, we're going to look at how I discovered and got to know my great uncle Henry, 85 years after he died in World War I, and also his older brother, my grandfather. So how did it all start after that telephone conversation with my colleague? It explained to me that the Commonwealth War Graves Commission had set up their own website and recorded all of the casualties from the First and Second World War online. And that meant that we could establish exactly who that great uncle was that my dad had told me about. So who was he? Well, he was Private L10209 Henry Stephen Wenham of the 6th Battalion, the East Kent Regiment, whose nickname was the Buffs. And it told me that he lived at 18 Brunswick Street in Maidstone, Kent, and that he died of wounds on the 4th of August 1916 at the age of 20. But most intriguingly, it gave me the precise details of Henry's burial site. We knew that he'd died on the Somme, and he was buried in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery at a place called Bousincourt, a village on the Somme, not far from a place called Albert. Bousincourt communal cemetery extension was where Henry was buried. So for the rest of that day, my mind was just not on my job. I really couldn't concentrate. I kept wondering whether this was my relative. Surely it had to be. What happened to him? He was only 20. At that stage, I was 36. So I was 16 years older than he was when he died in what must have been terrible circumstances. By mid-afternoon, I'd made up my mind. I had to find more about this soldier, who he was, and if he was my great uncle, I was going to visit his grave. Then I remembered that my uncle Dennis, who lived in Swindon, had researched our family tree. So I telephoned my uncle with my fingers crossed. He would know the true story of this. What he told me made me feel very emotional and even more determined to take a trip to the Somme and pay my respects to this young man. Dennis explained to me that Private H.S. Wenham was indeed my great uncle Henry. He was the younger brother of my grandfather Arthur, and he'd been killed fighting on the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And incredibly, Dennis remembered a story that his father, my grandfather Arthur, had told him when he was a young man. He'd said that he'd seen Henry, after he was wounded, lying on a stretcher shortly before he died of wounds. Not only that, Dennis had a copy of his birth and death certificate. And little did I realise at the time that that simple piece of information would later enable me to find out more about my great uncle Henry. Now, I did actually remember my granddad Arthur very well. He died in 1973 when I was just 8 years old, and we used to frequently visit his bungalow in Swindon that he shared with his wife Dolly, where they'd retired to after he'd lived in Kent for many years. I also remember my grandmother Dolly with much fondness, a gentle old lady who'd be very kind to us, and she made lovely cakes and used to wheel them into the living room on a trolley with tea for the adults and cold drinks for my brother and I. Dolly, as I was later to find out, was a heartbroken young lady that Henry had left behind when he died of wounds on the Somme. So just 2 weeks after discovering that Henry was indeed my great uncle who died on the Somme in 1916, I went off to the Somme with a couple of guys and we went in search of his grave. And it was an experience, like so many other people, that I will never, ever forget. It was a cold April day in 2001, and it was 5:30 in the afternoon when we headed toward Bousincourt, the place that I knew from the Commonwealth War Grave Commission records that my uncle was buried. There were two cemeteries in the Bousincourt area. One is called the Bousincourt Ridge Cemetery, but he wasn't in there. He was in a cemetery at the back of the village of Bousincourt, and to access the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, we had to walk through a local civilian cemetery. As we entered the Bousincourt communal extension at the back of the civilian cemetery, there was all these beautiful graves laid out, and I realised that this was the place not only where Henry was buried, but where he died of wounds. This was a field ambulance in August of 1916. So what had happened was I'd found out that Henry, the day before, had been involved in an attack on a German strong point. He'd been wounded and brought back 5 or 6 miles behind the lines in a field ambulance, hopefully a motorised one or a wooden cart, and here he's died of his wounds the day after he'd been wounded. But don't forget what we'd been told before we left home. The story was that my granddad Arthur, serving in the Royal Garrison Artillery, as they were moving up, the big guns moving up, he saw Henry lying on a stretcher. An incredible coincidence. There were tens of thousands of the soldiers in that area that night. And here we were, about to be the first people to see Uncle Henry after 85 years he'd laid in this cemetery. As far as I know, none of his family had been to see his grave. It didn't take long to find the individual grave of Henry. But as I wandered round looking at the other headstones, looking for his grave, all these thoughts came into my mind. How did he feel that day he'd been wounded? He'd seen, as we'll talk about later, battles previously in the war. He'd come through one of them. He'd been wounded in another. Was he scared? Was he conscious when they brought him here? How much pain was he suffering? But of course, we'll never know the answers to these questions. And within a few minutes, I'd found his grave. There it was. My family name on his grave. His final resting place. I had with me a small wooden cross with a poppy attached to it. And as I laid that in front of his grave, I felt tremendous sorrow and pity for him. like a million others, he gave his young life so that we could enjoy our freedom and all of the benefits that we have in the modern day society. But there was a couple of things on his headstone that really stood out for me. One of which was the fact that he was just 20 years old, as I mentioned earlier. When I think back to when I was 20, my life had only just started, really. And of course, Henry had not had a proper life. He'd given his life at the age of just 20. But then another thought occurred to me. What had happened was that Henry was engaged to the lady Dolly. Dolly, of course, was my grandmother. So it meant that at the end of the war, Arthur, Henry's brother, had survived the war. He'd gone back to Maidstone and he married Dolly instead of Henry. So it occurred to me that if Henry had not died on that day in August 1916, history would have been different. Arthur would have married someone else or wouldn't have married someone at all. He certainly wouldn't have married Dolly. And years later, 8 years later, my dad was born in 1924. And in 1964, I came along, followed by my brother in 1966. History would have been different had Henry not died. And there are those words at the bottom of his headstone. The words that his family chose. And what they said was, "He died so that we may live. He died so that we may live." Now, I understand that those words came from the Bible. But of course, in this case, it was true. He died so that we may live. If Henry, as I said before, had not died, our family history would have been different. And my dad, brother, uncle and I would not have been here to tell this story. It was an incredible feeling when I looked back and thought about those words and young Henry's life. So from there, we visited the Teepvale Memorial, the Ulster Tower, the Sunken Lane, and various other places that would become very well known to me on the Somme battlefield over the next few years. When I returned to England, I realised I'd managed to fulfil this lifetime ambition to visit the Western Front. And I never imagined that I'd find a relative's grave or learn so much about him and how he died. However, the visit just whet my appetite for knowledge, and now I wanted to find out more about Henry and also my grandfather's experience in the First World War on the Western Front. And the story, of course, didn't end there. It was the start of an amazing journey that brought me back to the Somme and Ypres over and over again, looking for answers to the questions I had in my mind. It took me to meet new relatives that I didn't know, but it threw up, of course, even more questions and mysteries. Over the next few years, I developed new skills and met all sorts of friends and acquaintances. And the journey made me understand my place in history and how the Great War was directly responsible for my existence. And eventually that experience in April 2001 turned me into a battlefield guide and researcher. And what I wanted to do now is to talk through Henry's service record and explain how he ended up in Buzincourt Cemetery. So shortly after returning to England, I explained to my dad and Uncle Dennis what I'd discovered. But of course, I didn't know what Henry looked like. No one had seen him. "Surely you've got a photo of him," I asked them both. "No, he'd been forgotten about after the war, never even spoken about." I was absolutely gutted. I was really disappointed. But a few months later, I travelled to Kew, to the National Archives, in the hope of finding Henry's service record. Nowadays, you can find them online, but in those days, they were still on microfiche. Now, I was aware there was only a small chance of finding his service record, because over 60% of the service records from World War I had been destroyed by a German bomb in World War II in 1940. And of the remaining files, many of them had been burnt during the subsequent fire from the German bomb and were completely unreadable. But incredibly, I was in luck. His entire file I found on microfiche, and it contained so much valuable and personal information about Henry, and it enabled me to be able to put together his full military service. His attestation form said that he was 18 years old and 285 days when he applied to join the Buffs on the 6th of August 1914. The 6th of August, 2 days after war had been declared on Germany. So he was one of the first volunteers to join up as part of Kitchener's army. It told me that Henry's regimental number was L10209 and that he was not married, but we do know, of course, that he was engaged to Dolly at that time, whose real name was Althea Emma Thomas. It also told us that his occupation, he was a farm labourer. A farm labourer in 1914 would have been a really difficult job. It would have been low paid, dangerous job with long hours. So perhaps joining the army was going to be a better option for Henry. After all, of course, the war was going to be over by Christmas. It told us that Henry was 5'5" in height and he weighed 119 pounds. So he was tall enough to join the army and he was old enough. He had grey eyes and light brown hair and he described his religion as Church of England. It also said in his physical description that he'd got a scar under his left ankle. Maybe that was, I don't know, a football injury, or maybe he'd hurt his ankle as a farm labourer, working as a farm labourer. But the one thing that really did attract me, that gave me most interest, was his signature on the attestation form. He'd handwritten his signature, of course, like you would do, and it was in beautiful joined-up handwriting. So that showed me that despite coming from a very poor working-class family in Maidstone, where Henry, I later found out, was the only wage earner, he'd still been educated, basic education at school, and had learned to write. The next document in his service record was the military history sheet. And the first thing it told me was from the 6th of August 1914 to the 6th of March 1915, Henry was at home. So that meant in the UK doing his basic training. And that was a period of 218 days. But during this period, on the 1st of February 1915, there was an entry which said that Henry had been found guilty of, and I quote, quitting his post when on outpost duty without permission. So there he was, guarding something or other down at Dover, where he was based at the time. And maybe he's gone off to the loo, he's gone off for a fag and he's been caught out. The offence occurred on the 29th of January 1915. We don't know what he did, but we do know that he was given punishment of 168 hours, field punishment number two. It then goes on to say that on the 7th of March 1915, Henry had gone off to the Western Front with his battalion. And he would have been one of the first volunteers to go off to the Western Front. And initially, they went off to the Ypres salient, just in time for the Second Battle of Ypres, the battle in which the Germans first used chlorine gas, and Henry and his unit were there to see it. What a welcome to the Western Front that must have been. The service record told me that on the 29th of May 1915, he was wounded by gunshot wounds in both feet. So that tells me that was probably machine gun fire rather than rifle fire. On the 4th of May, so 5 days later, he was admitted to the Southern General Hospital, Southmead in Bristol, which is still there. And 40 days later, with the wound healed, he left hospital and he rejoined his unit at their depot at Dover Castle, where he'd done his basic training in the previous year. Now, I do know that in between being released from hospital and joining up with his unit, he went back to Maidstone and no doubt met up with Dolly, his family. And I do believe he met up with his brother Arthur as well, who suggested to him that it'd be better off joining the Royal Garrison Artillery that Arthur was in, rather than the returning to the infantry. But unfortunately, if he did suggest that, it never happened because Henry went back and joined the East Kent Regiment. On the 28th of July 1915, so what's that, 4 months after being wounded, he's back in France and he joined initially the 12th Battalion and spent some time training at the Ball Ring in Etaples near Boulogne on the coast, the famous Ball Ring. He would have taken part with the 6th Battalion in the Battle of Loos in September 1915, and the last entry in his record was what we already knew, that he died of wounds at a field ambulance at Bousincourt. Now, Henry's service record also revealed that he wasn't always in the 6th Battalion of the Buffs. When he first joined the regiment in March of 1915, he was with the 2nd Battalion. The 2nd Battalion had already been out in France and Belgium for some time and had suffered casualties. So Henry, being one of the first volunteers to be trained, was a replacement. And then we move forward to the 21st of April 1915. This is the period now during the Second Battle of Ypres, the battle that we know that Henry was wounded by bullets to his feet. And on the 21st of April 1915, the Buffs were in billets in Ypres, but the city was being heavily bombarded by German artillery. So they moved slightly to the east of Ypres and took up positions in a small hamlet called Saint-Jean. The following day, the 22nd of April 1915, was a fine spring day. Once again, the Germans were bombarding Ypres in the morning, but for the rest of the day it had been quiet. It was usual for the bombardment to begin again in the evening, but this time something very different happened. Something dreadful that Henry witnessed and would change the nature of warfare forever. To the northeast of their billets in St. John, in the open fields around St. Julian, they noticed artillery fire and then a greenish vapour of some kind. This was chlorine gas, the first use of poison gas in history. Machine gun fire was heard too. How could that be? The Buffs in their position were 4 miles from the front line. The bullets were splattering into St. John where they were. It was French colonial troops that were holding the line, and they were retreating in twos and threes across the fields from the northwest. The Buffs' battalion diary stated, "It was at once apparent that something was wrong." What an understatement that was. So immediately, the Buffs were ordered to stand to arms across the crossroads that's in St. Jean and the road that leads in one way to St. Julian and the other way to Ypres. And as they did so, the Canadians were being marched through them up to the front line to reinforce the line. More French troops were streaming down the road towards Ypres, and they were choking and gasping for air. The Buffs had never seen anything like it. Nobody had in history, of course, and probably didn't understand what was happening. They stood nonchalantly, it says in the battalion diary, and there was even a report that they were amused by the sight in front of them. At 7 o'clock that night, Henry and his comrades were holding a thin line across the village of St. John, facing east and northeast. If the Germans breached this line, they would have a clear path to Ypres and beyond to the Channel and the Channel ports that the British were holding. At 3:30 the following morning, the Buffs were ordered to move up from St. John, and they were to take part in a counterattack to the left of the Canadians. Their trenches were screened from the enemy by a hedge, and the Buffs used it for cover, but beyond the hedge it was open country, with the enemy Germans entrenched approximately 900 yards away. So immediately the Buffs left their trenches, they were subjected to furious machine gun fire. They did find some cover behind a farm and a fence 150 yards behind that farm. And from here, the Buffs were ordered to move a quarter of a mile to the east with their 3 parallel lines of trenches that were only lightly defended. But they had to rush across open ground and they suffered heavy casualties, with 80 men being hit by machine gun fire. They were now ordered to halt the line here and became defenders rather than counter-attackers. And for the rest of that day, they were subjected to heavy shelling and rifle fire. And we found out from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website that 16 Buffs were killed that day. Only 2 of them have a known grave, with the other 16 remembered on the Menin Gate, not far away. The Buffs were relieved on the 25th of April and went back to dugouts, but they were still within range of the German guns. Now, we know from Henry's service record that it says that he was wounded on the 29th of April, but the Buffs weren't actually in the line that day, so it must have been a mistake, and he must have been wounded perhaps during that counter-attack and the defence of those trenches. The farm mentioned in the battalion diary is a farm that's still there. It was rebuilt after the war and is called Mousetrap Farm. Now, just a few weeks later, between the 9th and the 15th of May 1915, just over the border in France, was the Battle of Obers Ridge. It's hardly a ridge at all, just 20 metres high, but it was high enough to give the Germans an advantage over the British, with the deep drainage ditches and dikes dug in no man's land providing natural obstacles for the BEF to cross during this battle. Of course, the Germans had been there since the autumn of 1914. And I mentioned my grandfather, Arthur Wenham. He was in the 1st Siege Battery, Royal Garrison Artillery, and he played a vital part in this battle. As the heavy guns fired over the infantry and British trenches into the German lines, the enemy counter-barrage smashed into the ground between the British lines and their gun positions and destroyed the British telephone communications. But it was my granddad and others who came to the rescue. Whether he volunteered, I don't know. He never spoke about it to his 2 sons, Arthur or Dennis. But we do know that for his actions during those few days during the Battle of Obers Ridge, he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, the DCM, which is only one step below the Victoria Cross. And this is what his citation said, and I quote, "For conspicuous gallantry and ability during the campaign, and notably on the 9th, 15th and 16th of May 1915 at Rickburg, St. Vast, though continually under fire, He never failed in repairing any breaks in the line and was out under fire both day and night. It was mainly owing to his gallantry and resource that communication with the observing officer was completely maintained. Now, for some reason, it was 3 years before Arthur actually received his medal. And for some reason, which we don't know why he was there, he found himself in Dumfries in Scotland. Maybe he was on leave, I don't know, but the family has got no connection at all with Scotland. But he was formally awarded the DCM in a special parade. The local newspaper reported the ceremony, and it was a Captain Grierson that presented the medal to Arthur. The Provost mentioned in his speech that it was very remiss on the part of the authorities to allow almost 3 years to elapse before the act of gallantry and the actual award of the medal. But whether or not there was a delay, which of course there was, very proud that my granddad was awarded that DCM. So we now fast forward in time. We know that Henry returned to the UK from his wounds in the Second Battle of Ypres, and he'd been repaired and sent back and joined the 6th Battalion in time for the Battle of Loos. How much action he saw in the Battle of Loos, I don't know. So we'll fast forward to July 1916, and the 6th Battalion are involved in the infamous the Battle of the Somme. The Battle of the Somme, as everybody knows, started on the 1st of July 1916, and the Buffs were in reserve and took no part in the action on the 1st. On the 3rd, they did, at Ovillers. They advanced across No Man's Land, and they suffered terrible casualties with 274 casualties on the 3rd of July. Now, Henry was definitely in that action, but managed to survive. They were taken out of the line after that, but returned to action on that day, the 3rd of August, Thursday the 3rd of August, 1916, Henry's last day on earth. Their objective was to attack and hold a German strong point approximately 1 mile in front of the village of Poisiers, which was known as Ration Trench. And to tell the basic story of what happened that night, we use the Buff's battalion diary. It says at 9 o'clock PM, the Germans shelled English trenches, but French 0.75-inch guns turned on German batteries with gas shells and the shell fire stopped, therefore preventing heavy casualties. At 11 o'clock PM, Lieutenant Hamner and a party of bombers crept out under the barrage to be ready to bomb an enemy machine gun nest should it open fire upon the English when they advanced. At 11:15 PM, B Company went over the top and was joined by D Company, the English barrage lifting at the same moment. D Company then went through B Company to take the trench on the left of the strong point, and A Company was brought up from reserve. At dawn on the 4th of August, B Company found they were in Ration Trench and their objective was secured. And Lieutenant Hamner did most gallant work. During this action, he was awarded the Military Cross, but he died of his wounds 2 months later. So what would have happened next? It was obvious that Henry was one of those that was wounded in that action near Poisiers, or between Ovillers and Poisiers, on the 3rd of August 1916 in a night attack. And he would have been taken out of the trenches by stretcher and evacuated back to Buzincourt, where we know he died, using the BEF's evacuation process. And we know that at some stage, his brother, my grandfather Arthur, saw him lying on that stretcher. And that was the end of his story, really. He was buried the next day and forgotten about until I turned up on that April afternoon, almost 85 years later. But there was one last issue which I needed to resolve, and one issue that had been nagging away in the back of my mind ever since I found out about Henry. No photo. I didn't know what he looked like. I had to find out what he looked like. I'd read somewhere that bereaved families often place an obituary in the local newspaper to remember their lost soldier. Then I discovered that the British newspaper archive was located in North London in Colindale. So I'll never forget, it was one boiling hot August afternoon, and I booked myself into their archives. I was allocated a table and chair, and I sat there waiting delivery of the August 1916 edition of the Kent Messenger. Henry and his family lived in Maidstone. I thought this would be the most likely place that his family would have put an obituary in. It was a long shot, but worth a go. Now, the Kent Messenger was, like most local newspapers in those days, a weekly publication. It wasn't every day. It was a broadsheet, and there was loads of war news in there. The Battle of the Somme, of course, was in full flow. There were dozens of heartbreaking obituaries to the fallen men of Kent. Now, as Henry had died on the 4th of August, I thought there might be something in the newspaper during the next 3 weeks in August. Page after page I turned in that boiling hot room. My heart sank. There was nothing, not a reference to Henry whatsoever. I was getting hotter and hotter with no air conditioning in that room, and I was about to give up. I was really disappointed. But I carried on. I turned over the next page into September. And a few minutes later, I turned over the page on the 9th of September 1916, the Kent Messenger from that day. It was by now over a month since Henry had died. As I turned to page 5, there were 12 faces staring out of the page. I saw his face before I noticed his name. It was over 30 degrees in that room, but a cold shiver ran down my spine when I saw the young features of a soldier wearing a peaked cap with a Buff's badge on the front. He was staring straight at the camera, looking at me, I thought to myself. Beneath the photo were the words in bold, Private H.S. Wenham from Maidstone, the Buffs, killed in action. I'd found him. It was a moment in my life that I'll never, ever forget. And the words in his obituary had been penned, probably by his mother, and this is what she wrote. The painful news has been received by Mrs. Wenham from 18 Brunswick Street, Maidstone, of the death of her son, Private Henry Stephen Wenham of the 6th Buffs, which occurred on August the 4th from wounds received in action. About a year before, he was wounded seriously in both feet, but recovered and went back to the front. He was 20 years of age. And I just sat there for about 15 minutes, staring at Henry's young face and reading those terribly sad words over and over again. Words that, of course, had been written by my great-grandmother. Now I could put a face to the information I'd gathered about my great-uncle. So that's it, really. That's the story of my great-uncle Henry and my grandfather Arthur. And I've given you a bit of information about me and how I got involved in touring the battlefields and guiding the battlefields and doing the research. First podcast, as I said, I've just done a crash course, really, in how to use the technology and doing the recording and editing. Hopefully I'll get better at that and I'll be able to add more editing and perhaps some music and various other things. I'll await feedback, really, from everybody. Some of the images and the stories that we've talked about, if you go to my website, you'll be able to see photographs of my granddad and great-uncle Henry and my granddad's citation. My website is www.terrystours.co.uk, and I'd be very interested to receive any feedback, which you can do by emailing me at terry@terrystours.co.uk or through Twitter or through Facebook. I haven't yet set up a Twitter page for this podcast, but I'll be doing that over the next few weeks. What I really wanted to do was get the first podcast done. I'd been thinking about doing this for weeks. I've got the technology and the microphone and everything else, and I kept putting it off. So I've done it now. Over to you guys. Thanks very much for listening to me. I do hope it's of some interest, and it will be available on the normal places where you download your podcasts. So if you click the subscribe button, you'll be able to get automatic updates when I do the next one. And I'll speak to you all again soon. But once again, thank you very much for joining me on this first podcast, Tales from the Battlefield.